Hey, we are mixing things up a little bit this morning. Our regular routine is being changed up a bit. We are finishing this morning our series that we're just simply calling Sundays with Dr. Seuss. For the last 3 days, myself and Ruth and some of the other people from our staff were at a conference. The final speaker at the conference was a guy by the name of John Ortberg. He's a well-known author and pastor and a phenomenal teacher. He gets up and he starts his talk to this group of like 3,000-4,000 people, and he's using Dr. Seuss. And I leaned over to Ruth. I go, "Guy's stealing our stick, you know? Come on." But we have been looking at three different stories from Dr. Seuss to kind of launch us into conversation. And this week, we're dealing with a fantastic story, but it also happens to be one of his most obscure stories. How many of you have ever read The King's Stilts? See what I mean? There's about one, two, three, four. It's a very different story. It's one of his first stories that he wrote. And I thought, wait a second, each week we've had somebody be our Dr. Seuss reader. And I go, there's no way we can make it through the Seuss series without my favorite Dr. Seuss reader. And that's my wife. And so I'm going to have Jen come up and do the reading. But Jen was rather disappointed. She had never read The King's Stilts. And when she sat down and read it, she goes, wait a second, it doesn't rhyme. We're so used to Dr. Seuss stories always rhyming. Not this one. And so she'll be doing the reading. I'll be taking care of the pictures up on the screen. And enjoy.
Naturally, the king never wore his stilts during business hours. When King Bertram worked, he really worked. And his stilts stood forgotten in the tall stilt closet in the castle's front hallway. There was so much work to be done in the kingdom of Bin that King Bertram had to get up every morning at 5. Long before the townsfolk and the farmers were awake, the king was splashing away in the bath. It was right there, in fact, that his day's work began. With his left hand, he could bathe. With his right royal brush. With his right hand, he always had to keep it dry for signing the important papers of state. Eric, his page boy, brought in these papers on a big silver tray. He stood at attention at the foot of the tub, while old Lord Droon took the papers one by one and held them over the water for His Majesty to sign. "Sign here, sign there," old Droon would say. "And hurry, sire, hurry. There's hundreds more to come." It was just the same at breakfast. The king cut and buttered his toast with only his left hand. With his right, he kept signing royal orders and commands. By 7 every morning, the king had always finished more business than most kings do in a month. He had to get all this done before 7, for that was the hour when his big work commenced, the most difficult and important work in the whole kingdom of Bin. This was the work of caring for the mighty dike trees that protected the people of Bin from the sea. The sea pushed against the kingdom on 3 sides. The kingdom was a low one. The sea was a high one. And only the dike trees kept the sea from pouring in. They grew so close together in a row along the shore that they held the water back with their heavy, knotted roots. But to keep these trees strong and sturdy was not an easy task. They were more spicy than pine trees, and their roots were very tasty to a certain sort of bird. This was a kind of giant blackbird with a sharp and pointed beak. Nizzards, they were called by the people of Bin. These nizzards were always flying about over the dike trees, waiting for a chance to swoop down and peck. If nobody stopped them, the roots would soon give way. Then the sea would pour in with a terrible roar, and every last soul in the kingdom would drown. But King Bitram did not permit this to happen. He had gathered together in his kingdom the largest and the smartest cats in all the world and had trained them to chase the lizards away. These cats were called patrol cats and wore badges that said PC. Everything in Bin, said King Bitram, depends on our patrol cats. They are more important than our army, our navy, and our fire department too, for they keep the lizards away from the dike trees, and the dike trees keep the ocean back out of our land. 1,000 cats in all. They divided up the work. 500 guarded the kingdom by day. The other 500 kept watch through the night. At 7 every morning came the changing of the cat guard. At the sound of a trumpet, the king left his breakfast, mounted his horse for the daily review. Fresh, brisk, and well-fed, the 500 day cats marched past him toward the dike trees to take up their watch. At the same time, the night cats, muddy, tired, and hungry, headed home to their kennels for their 12 hours rest. There was rest for the cats. There was none for the king. It took every minute of his morning to see that they were given the very best of care. The huts that they slept in must be kept clean and tidy. Each class cat must be brushed and his whiskers trimmed just so. The cat kitchen was even bigger and grander than the king's, and the cooks who did the cooking were the chief cooks in the land. Your Majesty, the chief in charge of fish would always say, tell us that you think the food we feed our cats is perfect. And the king would look over the huge wet baskets of fish, choosing only the finest and the freshest to serve to his patrol cats. So went the morning, then all afternoon, both in winter and summer, the king made his rounds by the edge of the sea. Every root of the dike tree he inspected every day. But finally, at 5 o'clock, the great task was finished. Then the king smiled. A hard day, he'd say, full of miserly worries. A long day, he'd say. Now it's time for some fun. This was the moment King Bitram lived for. When he worked, he really worked. But when he played, he really played. Quick, Eric, he'd shout. Quick, Eric, the stilts. Down the slope from the dike trees, away from all troubles, the king and Eric would race like two boys straight to the tall stilt closet in the castle's front hallway. Out came the stilts. Up leapt the king. High in the air, his royal robes streaming, he'd race through the marble halls, out across the terrace, up and down the garden stairs. Black spotted coach dogs barked and romped beside him, nipping at the heels of his flashing red stilts. The townsfolks looked on from the walls and just loved it. A grown-up king on stilts, they'd say, does look rather strange. But it's hard work being king, and he does his work well. If he wants to have a bit of fun, sure, let him have it.
All right, now here I'm going to interrupt. And if you've been here the last couple of weeks, you might be thinking, wait a second. When Bill was reading and when Larry was reading, you interrupted all the time. Yeah, they're not my wife. I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. The story is one of his longer stories, and so for the sake of this morning, I'm going to summarize the rest of it, but still give you the pictures. Lord Drune. Lord Drune is described in the book as one that doesn't really enjoy fun. He thinks that all mouths should curve down. that a smile was not the way your face is supposed to go. And he is frustrated that the king would be so frivolous with his time and would run around on stilts. In fact, he implies that by running around on stilts, he's not able to accomplish even more work. And so he decides, what's he going to do? He's going to take the stilts and take them away from the king and hide them. And as he's getting ready to hide them, the king is coming up. And so he has to come up with a new plan. And so he calls out to Eric the page boy, and he gives him the stilts with the command, take the stilts, go bury them, and hide them so that nobody knows where they are. As a result, the king becomes rather depressed. And Lord Drune jumps on this to say, well, I've heard the townsfolk talking, and they think it's not right for a king to be on stilts. A king should be more serious. One of them probably took your stilts. And so the king is rather depressed, but it's like throwing a rock into a pond, and there's the ripples that go out and out, because when the king is down, the patrol cats become more and more lethargic. As a result, the nizzards become emboldened, and they start going after the dike trees. The people begin to notice that things aren't functioning as smoothly as they once did, and they're becoming a little worried. Finally, Eric the page boy realizes what's wrong. The king needs his stilts. And so he goes to tell the king, but Lord Drune intercepts him and banishes him into a room where he is quarantined because he, quote, has measles. Eric the page boy, though, swiftly escapes, and he goes and digs up the king's stilts and is all set to deliver them in just the nick of time, because water has begun to seep into the kingdom. But Lord Drune, hearing that he escaped, comes looking for them, but Eric, being a quick thinker, disguises himself as a man and says, are you looking for a boy? He went that way. And Lord Drune and the guards go that way. Meanwhile, Eric races off to the castle with the red stilts. And when he gets to the king, he delivers the red stilts again. And here is how the story ends.
Patrol cats. It was the loudest command ever shouted in Bin. The king's voice seemed to roll up from deep in his boots. It echoed down the valleys. It rumbled through the hills. From wherever they had wandered, the cats heard the call. They fell in line. They fell in step. They marched ahead 1,000 strong. Up the hill to the dike trees, they followed Eric and the king. Day cats to the left, night cats to the right. Charge, the king shouted. 100,000 nizzards stopped their pecking and sprang to meet the charge. The dike trees shook as the cats roared their war cry. The sea's surface swirled into wild, raging whirlpools. The noise was heard in Sambaland, 500 miles away. The fur flew fast, but the feathers flew faster. It only took 10 minutes. The kingdom was saved. The townsfolk stopped trembling indoors because of their window behind their window shades. They rushed out from their houses and filled the air with cheers. Then the king punished Drune in a most fitting way. He sent him to live by himself with a guard of patrol cats in the old deserted house with the sign that said measles. And he made him eat nizzards 3 times every day. Stewed nizzards for breakfast, cold nizzards for lunch, fried nizzards for supper. And every other Thursday, they served him nizzard hash. But to Eric, his page boy, the king gave a fine and just reward. He ordered the royal carpenter to make him another pair of stilts, tall stilts, red and flashing, exactly like his own. From then on, every day at 5, they always raced on stilts together. And when they played, they really played. And when they worked, they really worked. And the cats kept the lizards away from the dike trees. And the dike trees kept the water back out of the land.
The end. Now, I love the rhythm that exists in this story. And there's this great line, if you're taking notes on your bulletin, there's a great line, when they played, they really played, and when they worked, they really worked. This was the rhythm in the kingdom. This was the rhythm for the king. And as a result of this rhythm, it was a healthy rhythm. It was of benefit to everybody. Because of this healthy rhythm of when you work, you really work, when you really play, the king himself was in a better place personally. The cats, the patrol cats, were more responsive. The roots of the dike trees were stronger, and the kingdom was safe. But when this rhythm was broken, the king found himself in an unhealthy place. The cats were unresponsive. The dike trees were becoming less than healthy, and the kingdom was in danger. There's a rhythm that is healthy in the story. See, I remember the first time my wife kicked me out of the house. It wasn't the last time she kicked me out of the house either. But she looked at me, she goes, "Mike, you need to go." I'm thinking, wait a second, what kind of marriage is this? You know? And she goes, "No, Mike, you really need to leave. You need to grab your basketball shoes and you need to grab your basketball and go play." We were living down the street from a YMCA and she goes, "Go." She realized early on in our marriage that I have a high quota of play. And she looked at me and says, "Mike, you don't understand. When you go and play, the result is you're a better husband, you're a better father, and you're a better pastor. Go." And what Jen correctly diagnosed in me, we didn't necessarily have language for in our marriage, but now we do. And the language to describe what was needed was Sabbath. It wasn't something that we were practicing at the time, but we realized that without that healthy rhythm, without the red stilts, our marriage wasn't as strong as it could be. My work wasn't as strong as it could be. I wasn't the person God created me to be. We needed red stilts in our marriage and in our lives. And some of you, for the first time, are realizing the cross for this whole series is made out of red stilts. And some of you just noticed when I said that. In Scripture, there is a rhythm that is given to us, and that rhythm is Sabbath. It comes out of the Hebrew word sabbat, which means to cease. In the 5th chapter of Deuteronomy, this is what it says. It says, "Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all of your work. But the 7th day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your town, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." The rhythm that is described in Scripture is the rhythm of Sabbath. It's the red stilts in the big story. When you work, you really work. But when you play, you really play. Or when you rest, you really rest. Or when you Sabbath, you really Sabbath. This is the rhythm that we have been called to live into and out of. Here's the problem. When it comes to Sabbath, we tend to make at least 3 different mistakes. And on your bulletin, if you're following along, these are the mistakes that we tend to make when it comes to Sabbath. The first mistake is this. It's an identity issue. And you'll notice on the screen that in parentheses it says, "Imago Dei," or slave. When it comes to Sabbath, we have an identity issue that keeps us from really living into it. Imago Dei is a Latin term that means image of God. We were created in the Imago Dei. We were created in the image of God. And it was God that first modeled Sabbath. What did he do? During creation, he worked 6 days, creating the heavens and the earth and everything that is within it. But on the seventh day, he rested. He ceased. Sabbath. We were created in the image of God. We were created to practice the same rhythm so that when we don't practice Sabbath, in that moment, we are not being true to our core identity as people created in the Imago Dei, in the image of God. And instead, we choose the identity of a slave. And you might go, where are you getting the slave language from? It was right out of Deuteronomy. When God said, remember when you were slaves in Egypt. Remember when you were slaves, when you didn't get a Sabbath day? When your whole identity was built upon your station in life and the work that you did. We have a choice to make regarding our identity. Are we going to live out of our Imago Dei, or are we going to be a slave? The second mistake that we make when it comes to Sabbath is a suggestion problem. How often do we treat Sabbath like it is a suggestion and not a commandment? The passage I read out of Deuteronomy was from the middle of the Ten Commandments. But we don't like to treat Sabbath like it's a commandment. It's more like a suggestion. I mean, it doesn't make sense. If you worked more, you'd accomplish more, and more is better, right? No, it's a red stilt reality. What would happen if we treated some of the other of the Ten Commandments as suggestions? I suggest you don't kill. No, that's a commandment. Thou shalt not kill. It wasn't a suggestion. And yet we treat the idea of Sabbath like it was a suggestion, not a commandment. As a result, the sea floods in on our lives. It's a commandment, folks. It's not a suggestion. The third mistake that we tend to make when it comes to Sabbath is we practice a level of legalism. There's a certain way you do it. The Pharisees were guilty of this during the time of Jesus. And it's one of the places that he would butt heads with the Pharisees, who created all these rules and regulations about what is good Sabbath and what is unacceptable Sabbath. And they put all these rules, and they so piled rules and regulations that all of the grace that was intended to exist in Sabbath was pushed to the side. We don't do it like the Pharisees did, but we still practice a certain level of legalism. Try this. What day is the Sabbath day? Well, you guys are so nervous to say it out loud. Go ahead and say it loud. What day is Sabbath?
Sunday.
Oh, Sunday, according to who? Our Jewish brothers and sisters don't do Sabbath on Sunday. They do it Saturday. In fact, but we're Christians. Well, congratulations, but Christians didn't start using Sunday as the Sabbath day until about 330 AD under the time of Constantine. And if we are committed to this idea that Sunday is the Sabbath, what about the four people that have to work on Sunday? Oh, you're going to go out to lunch and you're going to be really glad that somebody's there to serve you. And if your house catches on fire, you're going to be really glad that the fire department's working on Sundays. What about those people? When we pile on more and more regulations onto what Sabbath is supposed to look like, we often push aside the grace that is intended to exist in that moment. So here's what I'm going to do. I listed three. There's plenty more, but I just want to list three today. Which one of these three are you guilty of? Which one of these three do you struggle with when it comes to the command to practice a Sabbath day? For me, I was looking at this list, and it's not fair to ask you this question if I'm not willing to ask it of myself. And the one that I found myself struggling with most recently was the identity one. How often do I allow my identity to be formed out of my job, my title, my performance, instead of letting my identity flow out of the Imago Dei? I'm going to put my wife on the spot. Which one of the three is the one for you?
Well, I could definitely put myself an identity, but I think probably more prominent would be the suggestion one. Unfortunately, I'm feeling just like slapped by God, like, come on, get it together. But I'm really good at resting during the week. You know, I'll come home from work and I'll take my hour and I'll go on the porch swing with a book and I'll just be still. And so I think I have maybe, ooh, I'm all three. I think I maybe took some of the legalism and thought, ooh, I kind of piecemeal it all week long. So like, I don't have to do a whole day because I'm resting throughout my week. So, but that's not what the commandment says to do.
Okay, we're going to turn around to you. We could probably pick all three to some degree. I want you to pick just one. Which one of these mistakes do you tend to make when, in regards to Sabbath? Is it an identity, suggestion, legalism? I'm going to have you raise your hand. So how many of you picked identity? That's where you find yourself struggling. Okay. How many went with suggestion? You treat it like a suggestion, not a commandment. How many legalism? You've put a bunch of rules and regulations on it. All right. This idea of Sabbath is something that I was not brought up practicing. I went to church most of my life, but Sabbath was never something that was talked about. And so it's something that I have had to learn more about, be far more intentional about. I was asked by a friend if I would teach a seminar at a retreat in August, this upcoming August, and it's a retreat for people that work with children and youth in the church. And the seminar I've been asked to do is how to get fired by the church. I know it's a catchy title. So I'm going to have a bunch of children and youth workers, and we're going to be talking about, hey, the best ways to make sure you get fired by your church. And one of the first things I'm going to tell these children and youth workers is this. Work in a church that does not support the practice of Sabbath among their staff, and be a staff person that does not have a personal discipline of Sabbath. It'll be the best way to move yourself toward getting fired. Because if you attend a church where the leadership does not support the practice of Sabbath among their staff, you're just going to get more and more burned out. And they're going to expect more and more from you. And if you do not have a personal practice of Sabbath, you're going to end up getting burned out. And when we get burned out and worn down, we start making worse and worse decisions. And that's how you get yourself fired. Don't practice Sabbath, first step toward getting yourself fired. And for me, I had to really wrestle with this. It's like, wait a second, what does my personal discipline of Sabbath look like? And so I've been studying and wrestling with this over the last handful of years, and I found some things that were really, really helpful. First was by a guy by the name of John Pattison. He said, Sabbath is the day in which we pause our striving and start abiding. Stop working and just simply be. Be with God. We talk about the yada, that God wants to be in relationship with us. Just be present. Have you ever sat down at a meal with somebody and they're constantly looking at their phone? It's rude. It's annoying. I'm guilty of it. It's not abiding. Abiding means I'm going to put away the phone and I'm going to turn off the TV and I'm going to turn off the radio and I'm just going to be intentionally present. Sabbath gives you the permission to do that. Pattison goes on to write, God looks down at us with absolute love. We set aside the Sabbath to meet that gaze. Oh, I love the imagery there. Sabbath is a day that we're given permission to simply be aware of the fact that God loves us. I loved it last week when Connor was sharing about his experience in Mexicali, and he talked about as he was praying for the first time in his life, he heard the whisper of God. We're usually too busy to hear the whisper. Sabbath, it gives you permission to just sit and recognize that God loves you very much and to hear his whisper say, I'm very fond of you. Mm-hmm. Kevin Emmert wrote, the Sabbath is a practical reminder that we are completely dependent on God. The Sabbath is this great day where you get to stop all your striving, all your working, and you go, look at everything provided for me. I like to think of it this way. On Sabbath, I get to look around and go, look at everything I have no control over. I can see the birds in the air and the trees, and I can look out on a clear day and see the snow on the mountains. I go, I did nothing to make those things happen. And you might think, how it's going to make you feel insignificant. Great, which makes God that much bigger. And when I eat on the Sabbath, I can be more aware of the fact that I did nothing to deserve this. And you go, yes, you did, Mike. You have a job. Why do I have a job? That's from God. No, Mike. You have skills and you have training, which is all from God. It's all from God. And on Sabbath, I get to meet that gaze and go, oh, look at this. It's all from him. And it's all for him. Jen asked me to come into her class. This was probably about 5 years ago. And she asked me to teach on something. I have no idea what it was. But as I was teaching, I said, everything that we have is a gift from God. In fact, every breath is a gift from God. And she had one student in her class that, let's just say, let's just say that. And so I said, everything we have is a gift from God. The very breath in our lungs is a gift from God. And this kid goes, no, it isn't. Christian school, by the way. It was awesome. He goes, no, it isn't. I go, what do you mean? He goes, every breath isn't a gift from God. That's my choice. I choose to breathe. It's an act of my free will. And I looked at him and I go, do me a favor. What? Hold your breath for 10 minutes. And he said, no. I said, why not? He goes, because I'll die. I go, you're not going to die. Hold your breath for 10 minutes. He goes, no. I go, why not? He goes, because I'll die. I go, you're not going to die. Hold your breath for 10 minutes. He goes, no. I go, you're not going to die. You might pass out unconscious. And while you're laying there all unconscious, guess what's going to be happening? You're going to be breathing. And it's not because you're choosing to breathe. It's because you are fearfully and wonderfully made by God. And my wife did a really poor job that day of hiding her sheer pleasure at this exchange with this student. But every day on Sabbath, this is day that we go, oh wait, I'm completely dependent upon God. Everything I have is from him and for him. My personal definition of Sabbath is this: stopping with greater intentionality. That's become my personal definition of Sabbath. Stopping with greater intentionality. This is what I get to do. And I'm going to do it on purpose. So I can meet the gaze, so I can hear the whisper, so that I can realize everything I have is from him and I can abide. So here we go. I'm going to have you choose one. I'm going to pick on my wife first, though. Which one of the four stood out to you?
Well, coming into the morning, it was greater intentionality. But I think the more I've been listening to you, the abiding, definitely the abiding with God and realizing, oh man, just that connection. And without that, I am in really bad shape. So I would pick that one.
All right, I'm going to ask you. Here's your review. Stopping with greater intentionality. Practical reminder of being dependent on God. Meeting the gaze. Mm-hmm. Striving. Nope. Abiding. Yes. All right. Which one of those four resonated most with you? How many of you picked this one? The day in which we pause our striving and start abiding. How many picked, this is the day that we look down the God, that God looks upon us with love and we on the Sabbath meet that gaze. The practical reminder that you're completely dependent upon God. Stopping with greater intentionality. When the king played, he really played, and when he worked, he really worked. As soon as that rhythm was taken away, life began to fall apart. God has commanded us to live a rhythm with red stilts. The question is, will we participate in the rhythm he's commanded us to live into? I'm going to ask the worship team to come up, and what we're going to do is we're going to practice a little bit of that rhythm. We're going to sing a couple songs, but then there's going to be a silence. There might be a slide up on the screen to help you reflect. And then we'll sing a couple songs and then have silence. And then eventually we'll in the service, we're going to practice some red stilt rhythm this morning. So let's go.